When it comes to fighting viral infections, vaccines are the best tool in medicine's box, but the rotavirus is a stubborn agent of illness in Southern Asia and Africa. Where the vaccine is 98% effective in North America and in Europe, in India is only 43% effective among children. And there's a puzzle to solve for doctors and researchers trying to protect children from this diarrhea-inducing virus. To be sure, 43% effectiveness is an improvement over no vaccine at all, but there needs to be found a way to match the effectiveness in developed countries for the people in developing countries. Young ones are suffering from repeated infections even after taking the oral vaccine. A similar problem with the oral vaccine for polio surfaced 3 decades ago, and it may provide some answers as to what may be done in order to help these children avoid getting sick from the rotavirus. Karina Storrs earned her PhD in microbiology at Columbia University studying HPV and HIV, and she is now a science journalist. She has written for Scientific American, The Science of Health, The Scientist, Discover Magazine, and CNN Health Online, among other publications. In researching this issue, she has traveled to India to speak with doctors and patients and medical scientists to find out what may be happening. This is Mike Habrick, and along with Greg Layden, I welcome you to Iconocast, the science and science advocacy podcast. This is the 4th episode. The issue of rotavirus has implications for infrastructure and how providing residents with clean water for hygiene affects the efficacy of vaccines. Sometimes the vaccine needs help. Karina and Greg, welcome to Iconocast.
Karina, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
As before we launch into a discussion of the rotavirus, which is what we're here to talk about mainly, can you give us a background on the polio story, which is a very closely related story and actually helps us understand the rotavirus story better? What went on with polio and polio vaccines in India?
Right. The polio story is really interesting. That is sort of what tipped researchers off to the problem of certain vaccines, oral vaccines in low-income areas. I actually got to travel to southern India, where one of the hospitals is located, that first noticed the problem, and they had a head start on the rest of the country because they were giving the oral polio vaccine, which is not the one we use in the U.S. anymore. But they started giving oral polio vaccine in the 1960s, and everything seemed to be going fine. Kids were getting 3 doses of oral polio vaccine, and then a doctor named T. Jacob John, who is still at the hospital, and I got to meet with him when I visited the hospital, which is in Vellore, India. He saw a young boy who is about 1 year old come in with polio paralysis. So that means that he stopped being able to use one of his legs. And Dr. John was really puzzled because, according to the records, it looked like this young boy had received 3 doses of oral polio vaccine, and they did confirm that he had poliovirus. It was paralytic polio. And so all the doctors took notice, and they started to think, well, surely there must be an easy explanation for this. You know, maybe the medical record is wrong. This young boy really didn't get the 3 doses of oral polio vaccine. But it didn't look like that was the case. And then, you know, over the next few months, they started to see a few more kids come in who had the 3 doses and still developed polio paralysis. And so they got to wondering and worrying, actually. When I spoke with Dr. John, you know, even though this happened in, like, the late 1960s, he has pretty vivid memory of these patients, and he felt really caught off guard because they've been giving oral polio vaccine all over the world for, like, I think about a decade at that point, and hadn't once seen, at least that he knew about, hadn't seen any cases of kids still get infected with polio and develop disease after getting vaccinated. So he, you know, he told me that he almost felt like guilty, you know, like the doctors had really urged parents, you know, we have the vaccine at this hospital, let us give it to your children with, you know, the other vaccines. And, you know, here it had let them down. So, you know, what they had been preaching to the parents pretty much didn't do what it was supposed to do. And so I felt like it seemed like he had, you know, a pretty emotional response And it sort of, you know, catapulted him to do the first studies in India. And those started to come out in the late 1970s, making sense of this and showing that actually when in these children, after they gave them oral polio vaccine, they looked at the levels of polio antibody, which they had a pretty good idea about the level of antibody they needed to see to signify that children would get protection from the virus. And they saw that there's a good portion of children who, you know, after one, two, three doses still did not, had not mounted this level of immune response. And, you know, they did some studies comparing the response that children in the U.S. have. And I think I had noted in one of my stories, I think about 90% of children have sufficient antibody levels after two doses of oral polio vaccine, and the levels were more like 30 to 40%. So 30 to 40% of children in this area of India have antibodies.
I was kind of curious, the doses that they were using back in the 70s in the United States and in Europe and so forth, was one to three doses, is that what they were giving children back in the 70s? For polio, is that how they based it, or were they getting more doses in India for another reason? Do you know?
Well, I think what they did in India when they started to give polio was, you know, pretty similar, if not exactly the same as what they had been giving in the U.S. It was the same vaccine, you know, the same three doses, about the same schedule. I think in the U.S. they had stopped giving oral polio vaccine. I think, you know, by the time they were giving it in India, the oral polio vaccine, they had already switched over to an inactivated polio vaccine in the U.S. Because of safety issues. So, you know, but they had done, you know, a lot of studies back when oral polio vaccine was still being given in the U.S. to know, you know, what the vaccine response should be. And I think they were trying to sort of replicate that in India. And turns out he didn't get the same response.
Okay, so now on the rotavirus, what is rotavirus and why should we be concerned about it?
Well, like the name suggests, it's a virus. It causes diarrhea, and it's pretty common in young children. They get infected. It's what they call a fecal-oral route, which means contaminated food, water, objects, you know, that small children pick up and play with. They can pick up some rotavirus on their hands and then hand to mouth and then get infected that way. And diarrhea is pretty much the thing to worry about with rotavirus. And it's really, I mean, it is more, I think, of a nuisance in places like the United States, because children get diarrhea and they go to the hospital here. And so it has economic impact. It, you know, makes parents have to take time off work to take their kids to the hospital. But kids aren't dying of rotavirus here. I think maybe 50,000 hospitalizations because of rotavirus diarrhea in the U.S. But then compare that to places like Bangladesh, which is where I kind of started my reporting, or India, or, you know, a lot of low-income areas in Asia and Africa, and there are similar rates of rotavirus diarrhea, but it, you know, leads to a lot more serious complications and is actually pretty deadly there, because the care is not at the same level. And it's getting better there, I think. But, you know, if you look in the U.S., and this is before rotavirus vaccine became part of routine immunization, I think maybe about 50 children a year were dying because of rotavirus. Although, you know, like I said, a lot going to the hospital and, you know, get sick. It's pretty miserable, and parents have to take them to the hospital. But then, you know, if you look in other parts of the world, low-income areas, you're looking, I think, at more like 500,000 deaths in small children, like children under five, because of rotavirus.
So what was
all of them, it's a major cause of diarrhea.
Yeah. Well, what drew you to that research to begin with? To look into
The whole story of rotavirus vaccine response?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I got my start as a scientist. I have been interested in infectious disease and immunology since, I guess, college. And then I went so far as to get my PhD in microbiology and studied human papillomavirus and then did a short postdoc studying HIV. So even though I knew I didn't want to stay in the research world, like the story of so many science writers and journalists, I am always drawn back to infectious disease stories or research related to immunology in the types of reporting that I do, and so this was sort of a natural appeal to me. I found out about the story though. It was pretty circuitous, I guess, like how I find out about a lot of what I cover. You know, it's not like, you know, I was skimming a journal table of contents, you know, like an academic journal, like you do, and I saw, you know, a study saying, you know, rates of vaccine response much lower in children in you know, Dhaka, Bangladesh, compared with the U.S. It was not nearly that straightforward. But I met a researcher who sort of introduced me to the other side, one of the other sides of the story, which is the gut disease that it seems like almost every child in certain low-income parts of the world has, and they were trying to, you know, develop a therapy to help children and help their guts recover essentially from a lot of different exposures that they have, and that led me to other researchers who in the U.S. who were studying gut disease, and one of them happened to tell me that one of the consequences they think of gut disease in low-income areas is that vaccines don't work as well, and well, certain ones like oral vaccines, and he said it sort of matter-of-factly, like, you know, well, this, you know, this problem, we think, you know, that's one of the outcomes of gut disease. And I was like, wait, what? You know, vaccines don't work as well in low-income countries, and so that was sort of like stopped me in my tracks. And even though I started down this other path, which I'm also still working on, which is that, you know, this area of gut disease, I got distracted trying to figure out what was going on with poor vaccine response. And you know, at first, I think, and this is sort of what when I was telling, you know, friends about working on this topic. We all sort of thought, well, you know, vaccine people, small children especially, maybe don't get the same benefit from vaccines, but because of all these other reasons that, you know, seem pretty obvious, right? Like in, you know, developing countries, you know, they have access issues. You know, the vaccine might not be available in an area, or like with rotavirus, because it's not part of the routine immunization in places like Bangladesh, parents can't afford it. So I was thinking, well, yeah, kids don't benefit from vaccines as much as they do here just because they're not getting them. But it was pretty fascinating to me to realize that it's not kids, I mean, kids aren't getting them that too, but even when they do, like in clinical studies, you know, that it's like the best case scenario, and researchers just don't see, aren't able to give them the same level of immune protection in you know, in some cases.
I was wondering, because somebody had asked me about that last night when I told them what our podcast is going to be on the subject of. They had mentioned that there was some question as far as whether or not the vaccines had expired, too. And I don't know if that was anything that you'd run into or that was just something they were kind of pulling out of their hat. And maybe not as effective because they had reached or gone past the expectation date. Do you know if any of that had been looked at? Is that the possibility, or is that just something that the person I was talking to might have just been guessing about?
No, I think that was one of the first things they thought when they noticed, especially with the polio story, where there was essentially no precedent for a vaccine not working like it does everywhere else in the world, you know? And so Dr. John, the pediatrician in southern India who first saw kids with paralysis after vaccination, after they assured themselves that this child did, in fact, have three doses, the records weren't incorrect, then they were like, well, okay, this is an oral vaccine, so you have to think about the cold chain and keeping it refrigerated, or at least maybe not keeping it refrigerated, but at least not, you know, let it cook out in the sun. And they were getting these, the doses at that time, they weren't being made in India. They were getting shipped from the UK, I think. And so that was sort of a natural question that they were like, well, in the process of transportation, you know, is the vaccine getting destroyed in the heat? And they, I think they pretty quickly ruled that out because they just took those, I think the vaccine doses, and they were, you know, able to show that, I think they had some controls where they, you know, were giving the same doses maybe to, you know, children who, you know, were not, you know, maybe not in poor areas, or, you know, different parts of the country. I think they also did some, you know, in vitro experiments where they were looking at whether, you know, the vaccine was able to, in cell culture, you know, maybe create, you know, the kind of response that they would expect it to see. So they were able to assure themselves that it wasn't just something simple like a vaccine, you know, getting cooked in the sun.
So the basic problem then is that the oral rotavirus vaccine is pretty effective when given in developed countries, but in several undeveloped areas, at least in these clinical studies, the rate of success of the vaccine or the degree to which it conferred immunity to rotavirus was way down in the lower digits, like 40% or something like that, instead of up closer to 100%. It seems like there's three kinds of explanations. The one Mike just mentioned, which you were saying is largely ruled out, which is there's something wrong with the vaccine. It expires. They get the cheap vaccine instead of the good vaccine. It's not really being given when people say it is, et cetera. But that kind of thing has been looked at and controlled for. A second probability is just, you know, people talk about herd immunity. There's a lot of just talk about vaccines, especially around flu season. People talk about the idea of, well, you know, if enough people get the vaccination for the flu, then there's a herd immunity. But if the exposure is constant and ubiquitous, herd immunity doesn't help the people who don't get the vaccine very much, because herd immunity simply reduces exposure to the unvaccinated people. And if the exposure is so at such a high rate, then it just doesn't help that much. Herd immunity has to be up. There has to be so many people vaccinated for it to work that it may not have an effect. But what you're narrowing this down to is the third possibility, it sounds to me, which is that there's a pathology that's associated with some populations, in particular in developed countries, which makes the vaccine simply not work in those individuals because of a gut-related pathology. Is that more?
Yes, I think that's what people think now. Although there are a lot of questions about what's going on the individual level in terms of health to compromise, I guess, the efficacy of these vaccines. So I think people I've spoken with have said it's probably not going to be so simple that you can point to one health problem. There's probably a number of factors that are going on, and I had mentioned this gut disease that, you know, is pretty prevalent in low-income countries, and that certainly does seem to be one of the issues. For a while, I think it was sort of circumstantial evidence, just because, you know, these were oral vaccines, and people were starting to understand that there were differences in the guts of people, not just children, but also adults living in low-income countries. And so they started to speculate that because of these differences, because of differences in the levels of bacteria and viruses in the intestines, because of differences in inflammation, a lot of things could conspire to make it harder for vaccines to get into the gut and do their job and provoke an immune response. And in the last, last year, there have been a couple studies that, not just looking at the association in terms of, there's still association studies, but they're looking more specifically at markers of gut disease and the population of young children where they give vaccines, and looking at correlations between the children who don't respond as well to vaccines and their levels of inflammatory markers in the gut. So that's starting to give them, I think, better correlations. That suggests that the gut issue possibly having some setbacks in terms of gut health, and actually what some people have called an inflammatory bowel disease of the developing world is definitely playing a part. And in addition to that, I think people think that there's other things going on. So one of those is that the nutrition could be different, especially in young children. They're breastfeeding, which is great. I think that the public health departments in these areas are promoting breastfeeding, but on the other hand, the breast milk could have high levels of antibody because of the mother's exposure to rotavirus, for example, and because of that.
Hey, Mike, are you getting some dropping out of the phone?
Yeah, I'm hearing a little bit of
Hello.
Can you hear us? Okay, I was just hearing a little bit of you had mentioned that you're using the noise canceling microphone.
All right.
But for a little bit, it got kind of fuzzy for me. But it seems to be okay.
Hello?
Do you want to? Can you hear me?
I'm going in and out right now.
Yeah.
No, not Let's very see. Well.
Okay.
Let's I'm see. Getting about five syllables from everybody right now.
Okay.
The Skype calls.
I heard everything that you were saying there, Karina. I didn't have any dropout on that especially when you're starting getting a little bit fuzzy when you're talking about the breast milk. Do I go back to the start over again on the breast milk and see how it records? Because this is, I don't know how it sounds to you. Can you hear me okay now? Can either one of you hear me okay? Okay.
Anybody can hear me now?
Yeah, it doesn't sound very good. Okay. Karina, are you there?
No, she's not back in yet.
Okay. Let's see.
This is just I think this is just Skype going bad. Are you going to call her back in, or should I call her back
in? Yeah. Do you want to try her and see?
Okay. Yeah, I'm trying that now.
Okay. I'm going to go grab a little bit of water here.
Okay. Hello. Hello. Okay. Okay. Can anybody hear me? Hello, Mike?
Yeah. Let's see. You hear me okay now?
I can hear you okay.
Okay, so try getting Kurt back in.
And make sure you're still recording.
It is. Yep, it just popped up and confirmed as recording. So let's see. Okay, so I'm inviting her back into conference. Let's see.
Yeah, okay. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, sorry about that. It sounds a lot better now.
Yeah, it does sound really good. Yeah, I don't know what happened. That was weird. Hopefully you didn't lose me for too long.
Not long. I think free Skype basically doesn't. I think it just drops out sometimes.
Okay.
You get what you say. Okay, well, let me ask you, we were talking about the problem of the rotavirus vaccine not being effective when it's taken orally in people who have perhaps some gut pathologies. How does the rotavirus vaccine actually get into the system to cause the immune system to respond properly to develop memory for future immune response? Is it something that happens in the gut itself? Or does it have to get past the gut into the blood system for that to work?
No, as far as I understand, it's happening in the gut. So the vaccine has the vaccine contains, in this case, weakened forms of rotavirus. And in order to develop a good immune response, those weak viruses in the vaccine have to establish an infection in the gut. So they have to get in there, get inside the cells in which they replicate. And so it's basically like a mini infection. The way the vaccines work. If they work the way they're supposed to, then they don't, cause disease, but it's still a very low-lying infection that is enough to elicit an immune response. So in this case, it's an antibody response where when the weak viruses are replicating, the antibody recognizes foreign particles associated with the virus and presents them essentially to the immune system and cells like B cells that make antibodies start to do their job essentially. So you'll get seroconversion, which means that, and you can then measure this in the blood, you get higher levels of antibody, which then when you're exposed to the real deal, wild type or, fully full force rotavirus, then those antibodies will be ready at the ready to bind and basically neutralize the virus, the infection.
So ironically, a weakened version of the virus isn't strong enough to get past the messed up part of the gut, in a sense. It's sort of an irony because the gut is, in a sense, resisting the virus. And when it comes in the form of a vaccine, it's resisting the vaccine, so the vaccine can't do its job, so that when the full, as you say, the full force virus happens to come along later, the immunity isn't there in place.
That's what people think is happening. It's still, a model at this point. It's sort of a picture that people have painted of how they what they think is happening, but they are starting to do the studies to test it, and so far it does look like gut pathology, and specifically inflammation in the gut, is not allowing the weak vaccine version of the virus to get in and do its job, right? It's too weak. They think that basically the inflammation in the gut is like wiping out the handicap virus before it can even take hold. And
now, you had mentioned,
Mm-hmm.
No, go ahead.
No, I mean, I was just going to point out, there's other things probably going on too, in other conditions or health conditions that are more common in low-income areas that are contributing to poor vaccine response. I think it's probably not just all a gut story.
You had mentioned earlier, too, about breast milk, and that's where we had the trouble with the Skype. Would you mind going through that again and how that affects the ability of babies to develop the immunity to coronavirus?
Sure. Yeah, this is another area where people, they think that this could be contributing, but evidence-wise, it's not rock solid. Mm. They, but the idea is that there's just more chances to be exposed to like rotavirus in the population, and so mothers have rotavirus antibodies from their own exposures, their own infections, and they can pass those to the babies, both in the womb through the placenta and through breast milk. And so, these women are encouraged to breastfeed, that's something that these health departments in these areas encourage. And I think breastfeeding rates have increased, but they think that it's possible that there could be the downside that babies are getting mother's antibodies and basically then not or less able to develop their own immune response to the vaccine.
That seems very interesting, but also kind of mysterious, because In early life, the adaptive immune system isn't that well developed, and you wouldn't think it would be doing much anyway. In other words, a transfer of antibodies via breast milk gives the infant some resistance to whatever that antibody happens to be for, but it doesn't necessarily influence the infant's immune adaptation because the system isn't really in place for several months. I mean, does anyone know how that works? How is it that the mother's antibodies suppress the development of a good immune response in an infant?
Well, I mean, it's possible that it goes, yeah, and I don't really know, but it's possible that if they already have antibodies, then that is another thing that's keeping the weak virus in the vaccine from being able to take hold. So if they, if they're maternal antibodies that normally are good, right? Yeah, it's true that young infants don't have a fully mature adaptive immune response, so the maternal antibodies can help protect them from infectious disease. But in this case, I think with the weakened virus, those maternal antibodies might essentially neutralize the infection again before it can allow the baby's own immune system to develop an antibody response. And again, I think the rotavirus vaccine, the schedule of immunization, it varies a little bit. I think in the U.S., it's either a 2 or 3 dose vaccine, and babies get the first dose at 2 months. And I think in some other areas they get it at 6 weeks. And I think that's sort of because, or maybe fully because at that time, the level of maternal antibodies, so antibodies at least that the babies were transmitted to babies in the womb, have sort of died off. The half-life of maternal antibodies, I think, is a few weeks. So by the time the baby reaches 6 to 8 weeks, they at least don't have as high level of maternal antibodies from gestation.
Right. That makes sense.
That researchers are looking at, especially in areas such as Bangladesh. This is one area, that's the area where they're doing the study, to see if it would help to give babies the rotavirus vaccine a few weeks later so they have even lower level of maternal antibodies. But, you know, that gets into the policy issues of, you know, do we really want to change the immunization schedule and now ask mothers to, you know, come back, make another visit just to get rotavirus vaccine? Or do we want to take the risk of postponing giving babies a vaccine if, you know, knowing that in those few weeks that you postpone it, maybe they will be exposed to rotavirus, or, you know, maybe something will happen and the moms just can't come back to the clinic again and they won't get it at all.
Yeah, the policy has to be one that actually gets the virus delivered to the person, and not just one that works better, but one that actually gets given to the person. So that's a really important part of it. In one of your articles, you mentioned, I think it was called the Pulse Project, I think this is done with polio in India, where the vaccine is given out to a lot of people all at once, which has the advantage of having the infrastructure for delivering the vaccine be organized in a way that might be more effective so that you can get it done more thoroughly. But also, it seems that the idea there is to hit the disease simultaneously everywhere, which may have a better long-term impact on the population-level health system. Is that, how does that work? Is that something that may solve this problem a little bit or help this be more effective?
Well, it certainly, I think, helped with polio and eradicating polio in India because of differences in between polio and rotavirus and just the kind of diseases they are. It probably won't be as big a part for, you know, trying to improve rotavirus immune response. But with polio, that's right, they have these, off being called, I think, pulse immunization, and that was when researchers were first testing the concept. And I think, again, it goes back to the pediatrician in southern India who first noticed the polio vaccine problem. He got the idea of just giving children more doses of polio vaccines. So instead of three, he was giving them four, five, six over, you know, several more months. And it seemed to really help that, you know, they didn't see any more cases of polio paralysis in the area when children are getting six doses. And I think he told me he got some pretty strong pushback from the government because about that time they had included oral polio vaccine in the routine immunization, childhood immunization schedule. And they, like we were saying before, they were pretty hesitant to decide to change the schedule or add doses once they had it established. But I think in the 80s and 90s, they were able to develop enough good evidence to advance the policy. And now, I think since probably for like the last 10 years, they've had essentially pulse immunization, but they call them national immunization days, where in addition to the oral polio vaccines that children get, you know, in the first year, couple years of life, they have these days twice a year where every child under 5 years of age in India gets an oral polio dose. So this is like, you know, hundreds of millions of children it's a Herculean effort to reach them all, and you know, millions of healthcare workers and volunteers doing the work, and so you can imagine like the effort that this is, but they've decided that it was worth it, and you know. I think WHO did remove India from the list of polio endemic countries a couple years ago, and the experts I talked to said that the pulse immunization or national immunization days played a big part of that. So I think essentially they, you know, they realized that they're not getting the bang for the buck for that, you know, other countries get with three doses, but it's sort of, you know, the more doses you give to the children, the more children are going to, you know, those children who don't respond, you know, you're basically going to give them enough finally so they do develop an antibody response. They develop antibodies to polio. So it's basically just, you know, hitting it, like brute force overcoming, you know, the problem.
Yeah, I've always thought that if for diseases that have primarily a human reservoir, so for example, the influenza viruses that affect humans, or something like malaria, which we often think of the mosquito as being the reservoir, but it's actually the human that's the reservoir, and the mosquitoes are the vector. If you could get everybody in a large region to just stay away from everybody else for 14 days, so, and, you know, quarantine, a perfect quarantine for an entire population, those diseases would more or less vanish because they would die out in the individuals, and there would be no people with malaria from mosquitoes to transmit the malaria from, or the influenza virus. But isn't I'm not sure if I'm remembering correctly. I might be confusing rotavirus and norovirus, but isn't rotavirus good at surviving just sitting around in water and other places? Isn't it something that actually is in the environment relatively secure, doesn't die off in the wild that easily? In between human infections?
I don't know how stable rotavirus is in the environment. I don't know. I'm sure people have done studies, you know, like, you know, they have with flu or herpes viruses to see how long they last just on, you know, a table or a doorknob or something, right? But I know that rotavirus has peak season in the winter, actually, which, you know, winter in, you know, South Asia is not like winter here, but it's still like the cooler, drier months. And mm-hmm. So that would suggest to me that, and, but, you know, people, I don't think they really know why winter is peak season for rotavirus, but to me that would suggest that the virus might be more stable in the cold, but I don't know how stable. And then also, you know, there is so much, I think part of what makes the prevalence of rotavirus so high in places like, you know, Asia and Africa is because, you know, a population. So, you know, it's big cities like Dhaka and Vellore, I think, where, you know, people are crowded together in kind of slum living conditions. And so even if the virus weren't that stable, I would assume that it would do just fine because it would probably meet its next host before too long.
Yeah. Yeah. We're having an interesting, you mentioned the seasonality, and I think you're right. With a lot of viruses, there's a strong seasonal effect, but it's not fully understood why there is a seasonal effect at all, including with influenza. We're having in the U.S. right now, I think, a relatively low-level influenza season. In Minnesota, we've had almost a record low level. There's been very, very little of it until just now. It just started to increase in its frequency. I don't know if but it's still not peaking. We're not getting a very high peak of virus, but we're getting, and we're finally getting an influenza season in Minnesota just this week. And it's, of course, an El Nino year. We're having a very warm year. This winter locally is more like a fall or spring all year. And I wonder if that's having it'd be interesting to look at the final results for all the epidemiology of the seasonal viruses with this El Nino year and see if it's had a global effect on either positively or negatively on these diseases' distribution.
Right, that would be interesting to see. But then, you know, things like, I think, cholera then peak in the warmest months. So you might get a break in what, you know, flu, rotavirus, then you're going to just get hit harder with other diseases.
I think a study like that would also have some implications for helping understand the effects of global warming on disease as well, even though that's a shorter term, could have some indicators. So that would be pretty interesting to see what, you know, find out.
So, based, again, on the things you've written, it does seem like a big problem that has to be solved is the general pathology of guts, especially in children. That is probably having... That is probably making rotavirus a much worse problem in places like India and other developing areas than it needs to be. And a lot of that probably has to do with sanitation, water, and sewage, right? What is it about India, for example, that makes what is standing in the way of India having a generally universal clean water supply and a generally universal good sanitation system?
Wow, yeah. I mean, it's I think it's a huge obstacle, and maybe it's probably a combination of many factors, you know, political will, you know, being government being willing to invest in the infrastructure to improve sewage systems, to improve water supplies, you know, ground surface water supplies. And I think, you know, it's also just, and sorry, hugely also economic. And I think that there have been improvements, actually. You know, it's sort of a victory and then also a bit of a curse. I think India is technically no longer Gavi eligible. So Gavi is the vaccine alliance that helps a lot of low-income countries pay for vaccines. And I think as of recently, because the gross national income in India has reached a certain level for the last few years, that they're technically no longer Gavi eligible, which is great. But then also, as they introduce new vaccines, that, you know, might be more difficult to afford them. But I guess that also means that, you know, I think so much of it has to do with, you know, with poverty and, you know, just people, you know, maybe not being able to afford at the individual or community, local level, better sanitation. And I think that, you know, in addition to the improvements in, you know, income, people I spoke with, doctors in India said that, you know, rotavirus is still, you know, a major cause of diarrheal disease, but when children get it, it's not causing as many deaths because, you know, clinics do a better job of caring for children. And then in addition to that, I think there probably is less diarrheal disease overall because there have been improvements. I mean, people have pointed to people drinking more bottled water, actually, in India, which you might not necessarily think is a good thing. In the U.S., I think, at least in the circles I keep, it's kind of discouraged because it's wasteful. But there, you know, if you don't have a good source of water, you know, well water is contaminated, drinking bottled water can probably improve your gut health and reduce your exposure to infectious disease by quite a lot. And sewage systems are getting better. They're, you know, being, you know, they're bringing in concrete sewage systems instead of mud ones where, you know, the waste just kind of gets absorbed into the ground instead of, you know, running off. So I think, you know, people have said that there are already improvements, but, you know, it's slow going and, you know, low-income countries are becoming less low-income or middle-income countries, and probably that's going to go a long way in reducing prevalence of these diseases, or at least mortality associated with these diseases.
Yeah, I've been lucky, as many of us have, I've been lucky to, you know, live in a, in at the two ends of the spectrum, where, well, we're here in Minnesota and in generally developed countries, we spend a huge amount of expense and energy and money and time on our infrastructure. So we had the inconvenience of having a lot of trucks in our neighborhood last summer because they were relining the sewer system, and we have pretty good water supply. So you can drink any water out of any tap in America and not get sick most of the time. And the other end of the spectrum is when I was a teenager, I spent a lot of time up in the Adirondack Mountains where you didn't have to even carry a canteen. You would just stick your face in the stream and drink out the water and never get sick from it. I think that's not true anymore in a lot of camping areas in the U.S. because of Giardia. And I lived in the Congo where you'd think it would be the most disease-ridden place in the world, but in the remote areas, the streams are all clean. There's just no problem drinking water right out of a spring or right out of a stream, right out of the ground. But everything in between, where there's a lack of infrastructure for water and sewage, and at the same time a lot of people, it's a pretty much global problem that the water supply is going to be dangerous and tenuous as to, in some areas, whether water is available, other areas whether it's clean enough to use. And that's it seems to be a growing part of the human population is under that stress. Places at, with relatively few people are getting still getting contaminated. Places with lots of people where it's just so difficult to put that infrastructure in place that it's, in addition to that, by the way, in your writings, you've talked about, you know, rotavirus and other diseases. The other difference is not just first world developed countries and third world countries, but it also is, seems to me, moist versus dry and tropical versus temperate. You know, India is a relatively moist, warm country, and a lot of the places in Africa we're talking about, plenty of places in Africa don't have these problems because they're arid, and we just don't have this kind of disease. It's in more moist areas, the better watered areas, and there is, of course, a long-term correlation between temperate, cooler environments being developed countries and the damper and warmer places being the former colonies and the these days less developed countries for all kinds of reasons. That underlies all of these health problems in some ways, I think.
Right. And at the same time that India was starting to see its, you know, first cases of polio in vaccinated children, they researchers sort of almost serendipitously found out about other cases in places like Brazil and Africa where there were cases of polio in children who are vaccinated. I think that, I mean, every disease is different. You know, polio seems like one of those, right, where it's, you know, maybe in cooler, drier climates. But, right, I think a lot of these, like, you know, cholera really thrive where it's a tropical climates, right, where it's warm and moist, humid.
Yeah, when I worked in the Congo in the 80s and in the 90s, my cohort, the people who lived there who were my age, maybe 10% of the people had been afflicted with polio, there was a global polio resurgence epidemic in the 50s and early 60s, and they were born around then. I think that that's what happened then. And I remember treating people. We got from Belgian missionaries treatments for leprosy, and we had a number of people that had leprosy in our study area, and we were treating people, as to the extent that we could. It was very hard to get the leprosy drugs, and the leprosy drugs required taking a single pill every day for a long time. I mean, I think it was like 45 days or something. And pygmies who live in the rainforest, it's very hard to get them to take a single pill every day for that long because of their mobility patterns and so on. But I remember visiting in a nearby city some folks and having dinner, and there was a guy from the UN there, and he was traveling around on behalf of WHO and doing some outreach. And they were very proud of the fact that they had wiped out leprosy in Africa. It was on the list of diseases they had wiped out. And I had to tell them and show them pictures of my friends who actually were suffering from leprosy. It's an endemic disease in the Ituri Forest. A lot of people, by the time they're a certain age, have it. And I think part of that is just there are parts of the world where we know a lot about disease and epidemiology and parts where we don't. And we think we might think we do, but we simply don't. And that's my experience in the Congo was basically that, you know, most people didn't know what was going on at all. We had no idea. And when you see numbers, I have to laugh, you know, when you see numbers of how many people in the Congo have malaria, it's like, well, when you live there for several years and you don't see anybody ever come by to count anybody, not even once, I just don't believe those numbers. It's just these are very just rough estimates. This is my, you know, most shows I go into a rant of some kind or another. This is my rant that no matter how much we think we know, we actually even know less than we think. In other words, the world health situation is probably whatever we think it is, plus about 50% worse.
Right. Yes. It's so hard to cover all of the areas, especially ones that are more remote, right? It's totally the scenario of, you know, finding what you look for that happens to be under the street lamp post or, you know, whatever that, you know, an analogy is. And I sort of, you know, in a way, in doing my reporting, I felt like I was, you know, casting this really negative light on, you know, places like Bangladesh, like Dhaka or, you know, southern India. But I think we just happen to know about the problems there because they have, you know, some of the best research institutes and hospitals for, you know, children's diseases. So it makes it seem like, well, this is a problem, you know, in Bangladesh and southern India. But I think that's just, you know, that's just capturing what's probably going on in all over the region.
It's just
not being studied there.
Yeah, it's this interesting juxtaposition of a country like India, which has a space program and one of the highest rates of education in certain areas of any comparable country, and at the same time, you know, absolutely horrible health conditions in some places and really bad medical problems. And that's what allows us to both know something about it, maybe do something about it, but also just have the problem be so large. But what is your
right.
You have something coming up soon on a cable network, CNN or something that you want to talk about?
Yeah, well, that's my story coming out on CNN Health website. So
okay.
It won't be on TV, as far as I know. But it will just I don't think it's going to be covered on any shows. But it will be a story on the website and then a photo gallery of pictures I took from my travels in, I think, just around Bangladesh. I published a story in Health Affairs Journal in the February issue, which was a bit more of an historical look, I think, at, you know, what the story of polio vaccine problems can tell us about trying to improve rotavirus response and response of other oral vaccines. And then in the CNN Health story, it is a journey, I guess, through how health researchers, public health researchers, are trying to make incremental improvements. So it's not going to be like we can just, you know, overnight make everyone have, you know, healthier guts or, young
mm-hmm.
children have healthier guts. It's going to be, you know, trying to find little ways to try to improve them, improve that, maybe probiotics. Maybe changing the schedule of the vaccine doses, maybe anti-inflammatory medicine, you know, a lot of little things like that, you know, could add up. I think that's what people are hoping anyway. But
well,
I don't think anybody thinks they're going to have a magic bullet. I think that was actually what one researcher even said, there's not going to be a magic bullet.
I read your story, and what I really liked about it is that you did a really excellent job of painting this picture that of great deal of complexity of things interacting.
Mm-hmm.
It normally, if you want to solve a complicated problem, you hold as much as you can under control and change a few variables and see what happens. And this is the kind of situation where you just can't do that. There's so many different factors involved. And over time, more factors are discovered and make things more complicated, and there's almost no way to, not only is there not a magic bullet, but if there was one, there would be no way to even discover it, it seems.
Right, yes. it was a kind of a difference in attitude, I think, between the researchers who are at, the research institutions in, Dhaka or Vellore, and the ones, researchers from the U.S. who travel there to, oversee the studies or, take part in analyzing the data, but aren't as steeped, I guess, in the day-to-day life there. And, with them, it's, they're taking an approach where they're really trying to control for issues and, see what really makes a difference. And, it's hard though. I mean, it's a clinical study that's messy no matter how you do it. But there, it's like there's so many different things that could be affecting vaccine response. Some researchers there were, it's kind of a dichotomy because it was a bit of a defeatist attitude, like, we're just going to have to improve sanitation. And until we can do that, what's the point of trying to make incremental improvements? But then on the other hand, there's sort of this attitude like, well, it's vaccine problem is, we'd like to improve it, but, even the way it is, we are reducing rates of like rotavirus diarrhea, by like 50%. That's huge. This mm-hmm. is something we should be really happy about. And they are. I mean, these countries are starting to include it in routine immunization. It's sort of a little bit of both, I think. It's, really appreciating what a big problem it is to improve it even more, but at the same time saying, well, look, this is, before the vaccine, the rates of rotavirus diarrhea and death were probably going to be much higher. So, this is a big step already.
The purpose behind the Iconoclast podcast is really has a lot to do with how does science affect and how should it affect and how should it inform public policy. And I found initially about the work that you were doing here on the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting site. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the drive is behind the Pulitzer Center and how you got involved with getting a grant from them to do some of the work that you're doing on this rotavirus issue.
So this is the first time I've worked with Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, so I can't, speak entirely to...
Sure. It's debating a little bit, but...
Okay. Yeah, no, this is the first project I have done or been funded to do by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. And I've got, probably just a small sense of what their bigger mission is, but I think there's at least a couple things that, to me seem really appealing, that they want to fund reporters to cover issues that are undercovered. And I think if you scroll through the projects, you see a lot of it has to do with health and also areas that are affected by conflict or war. So I think that ends up being, a lot of stories in Africa and Asia, South America, I guess what you would think of as developing areas, but they also have projects in the U.S. and I actually just noticed walking down the street in my neighborhood yesterday, a photo exhibit just, on the side, along the side of this long, church of, scenes of poverty around the United States, and I was reading who funded them, and one of the sponsors is Pulitzer Center, and so it reminded me, they also fund researchers to write about or do multimedia projects on, issues right here in the, what for me is home anyway, the United States. Mm-hmm. And then there's this, I found out about Pulitzer Center. I mean, I kind of knew about them, but I pitched the story of, just you know, hey, oral vaccines don't work as well in some low-income areas, which, you know, kind of tragically are the places that need them to work the most. And I pitched that to an editor like about a year ago, and she really liked the idea and suggested that I apply for a travel grant and even mention Pulitzer Center. And I hadn't even thought about getting to travel to do this reporting. I had already talked with a lot of researchers in the U.S. who were involved in studies in Bangladesh and India, so I kind of got a lot of the sense of it already, but with the grant money, I was able to travel and talk with families who have been affected by rotavirus, even though or their children had developed rotavirus diarrhea, even though they had been vaccinated, and of course, as a researcher, reporter, you know that it means so much to actually be able to go there,
sure,
and you know see the living conditions. And what kind of health access they have. And so, you know, that just, I think it really, you know, allowed me to, you know, bring those stories, hopefully many stories up to, mm-hmm. you know, another level. So, you know, I'm really happy to do that. And then I know Pulitzer Center also has an education component. I don't know if, you know, this is something of interest to you, but the Pulitzer Center is trying to, take the projects that come out of the reporting they sponsored and share them with people who develop curriculum at all levels. I think elementary school, high school, university, as a way to try to make problems, or help problems come to life for these areas. And because a lot of what they do is like health and science, I think that, that it could lend itself pretty well to, classroom lessons about how you would design experiments or, what kind of policy could come of this, what kinds of questions should you ask. So I think that's, that's pretty neat that I think more recently they shifted towards education or added education.
Karina, in your travels, did you stay healthy?
Yeah, I did. I took it pretty easy, I had my bottled water on me at all times, and I'd actually, just in prepping for, my reporting, I ended up taking a lot of it, to heart myself. The doctors I spoke with had talked about ways that they're helping children, when children still get diarrheal disease, rotavirus diarrhea, how they're at least helping children not, be as affected by it or, worst case scenario, die from it. And they were telling me about zinc supplements, and I thought, well, I should probably pick up some zinc supplements too. So I was basically, shopping for the interventions that they had been testing there, at my drugstore. And, so I was A-okay. I didn't have any trouble at all.
One other quick question I want to ask. I know that in Pakistan there was a lot of resistance to vaccines because it came out that a lot of the healthcare workers were actually CIA agents. You mostly traveled to India. Had you heard anything about resistance to taking vaccines because of that, or is that really not an issue in India that you knew of?
I mean, I think that they do have a bit. I don't know about, where I was in India in particular, but I think that, everywhere anymore, there's probably a bit of anti-vaccine sentiment. Mm-hmm. And I didn't experience that firsthand, no, but just some researchers I had spoken with, and I can't remember now which vaccine it was, but there was some pushback from parents thinking that, it was going to make their children more likely to get the disease or, it's a bit of a parallel with what's happening in the U.S. with parents. Hesitation, some parents, I think it's still a small group who are hesitant to get their children the, measles vaccine or, other vaccines. So, but actually the parents I talked with were all, really grateful to be in the study and to have got the rotavirus vaccine for their child. I guess they can't have the same kind of anti-vaccine sentiment about a vaccine that is not available to them. And in that case, it sort of flips it, and, you know, what's not available, they really want. I think they live with the disease that the vaccine would prevent, and so they know firsthand the value of the vaccine, and they're eager for, like in Bangladesh, for the government to approve it to be part of the routine immunization. Even the mothers whose children still got rotavirus were not like, well, your vaccine failed or your vaccine didn't kill rotavirus. It was like, you know, this, I don't understand why it happened. That was one mother I quoted in the health affairs story. She asked me, like, I had an answer.
No.
Like, you're going to have to talk with the researchers about that. They're trying to figure it out. But they were still, you know, I think they understood that that the vaccine, there's still a good chance that it could help. And even if it's not helping, you know, even if their child still got diarrhea, the vaccine might have prevented some cases of diarrhea. You know, there's evidence that even if the vaccine is not working as effectively as like in the United States, that it's still reducing the incidence of severe diarrhea. So when children get diarrhea, it's at least less severe. So I think maybe there's just more of an interest, desire to have the vaccine there, and also maybe more trust in the healthcare workers and, you know, the clinic.
Yeah, I have a sense that anti-vax is more of a first world conceit, and that's why we have it. It is true, though, that vaccination played a role in the killing of Osama bin Laden, as I understand it, because the CIA operatives who were in the area trying to get information on whether or not he was in that compound, they went undercover, or their colleagues went undercover as a team of people going, healthcare workers giving vaccinations to kids, and they got in the compound, and were very quickly, people got very suspicious and tossed him out right away, at least according to one documentary I saw. So, but yeah, that's an interesting question.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Yeah.
This is a problem. You know, anthropologists have this issue. Healthcare workers have this issue. There's a general ethic. You know, we all have had this happen. If you're in the field enough, eventually the CIA gets a hold of you and they ask you for information, or they help them out with something. And there may not be anything inherently wrong with that. I was contacted by the CIA once because there was a group of people in the Congo that were heading in the general direction of, they thought, where the bonobos live in the Kubet in the Congo. And they wanted my opinion on the possibility that these people were actually going to make it there, and whether it would, and that would impact them. I thought it was kind of nice of the CIA to be interested in helping the bonobos.
Yeah.
Eventually you get asked or approached by some intelligence agency, the British or the Americans, and the rule is don't do it because you don't want to lose the trust of the people that you work with. So it's an interesting thing. Things have gone wrong. One of the reasons why a lot of research stopped in Ethiopia on human origins research in the late 70s was because of this kind of thing happening. Ethiopia was at the center of a Soviet-U.S. conflict about listening stations, and the revolution had happened there. There was a major Cold War. It was a Cold War battlefield, in a sense, and somebody got pegged as a CIA agent, probably not correctly, but it caused the Ethiopians to throw all the scientists from all the countries that were there out. And for the next decade and a half, nothing happened. The upside of that was that Ethiopia then invested in their own scientists. They basically paid the cost for some people who were in college to go through the whole process of getting their PhDs and getting field experience in Kenya and elsewhere with other researchers to actually go back into Ethiopia and be the scientists doing that human origin research themselves. But now Ethiopia has a strong human origins program because initially everybody got mad at the CIA, threw some people out, and then they got their own program going.
So it was a silver lining, but it's sad that it had to come to a halt for a while there.
Yeah.
And I don't. Are you even able to refuse the CIA the information you have?
it's
do you have
it's
that?
It's interesting. You know, I ran into a CIA agent in Asiro, Zaire one time who wanted to visit our research site as an American traveler. And I gave him, I said, yes, he wanted to go with me. I was in this town getting my car fixed. And I said, you can come with me, but I can't leave town for 3 days because of the car being broken. And he said, well, we're going to go ahead. I got a translator from Kinshasa. We're going to go ahead and we'll just stop there. So I gave him a letter saying to my guards who were there, just when these guys show up, don't let them in any buildings, but give them a place to sleep and feed them. And they're going to ask you some questions. Just be polite. So I arrived about a week later, and I said, how did it go when that guy came? And they said, well, yeah, it was interesting. He only spoke English, but his guy from Kinshasa translated for us. I said, yeah, well, how did that go? He said, well, he said to us that they wanted to do an experiment. I said, yeah, what was the experiment? He said, well, they were going to find 6 volunteer pygmy men and bring them back to the United States and have them have sex with 6 women to breed a crossbreed of it, a pygmy man and an American woman, just to see what would happen. And I said, okay, fine. So about 6 months later, I was back in town, and I told a colleague of mine who was a European expatriate who had been living in Zaire since the 50s the story. And he said, yeah, I've heard that before. That's an old story. And, in fact, since then I've heard it again and again, some version of somebody in the Congo having, you know, sex with somebody from America to produce some outcome. One version is that's how they got AIDS. Another version is the one I talked about here. And I can imagine the guy from the Congo, you know, he works for the Mobutu government. He's got a CIA agent next to him. So what does he say? The CIA agent says, so how do you like your government? And the guy from the Congo says, so they're going to get 6 pygmies together. How's that sound? Okay. And so do you feel you're represented in the fair and open elections? And then the guy translates that as, and then he's going to have them go back and have sex with 6 women in America. And they'll go, okay, fine.
that's so funny. Right, okay. Yeah. You know, I guess hopefully they won't. They'll give them the response that they expect, which is sure, okay, and
right,
not
exactly.
Oh my God, are you insane?
But because it's an old story, if everyone kind of expects to hear it, it's just
code.
I can't really fully explain what happened, but that's how they
wild.
Get information. And there's really nothing inherently wrong with that. I mean, it depends. I mean, a colleague of mine was asked by the MI5 to photograph a bunch of bridges in Uganda where he was working. And, you know, that's a little different. That's getting together information on, you know, how to invade this country. Because you need to know where the bridges are and how big they are, if you can drive tanks over them and that kind of thing. As opposed to, you know, what's going to happen to the bonobos. I guess I'm a little bit ambivalent about it because a good friend of mine from back in the fieldwork days, actually ended up being one of the chief CIA guys for Africa. And I know him. He's a nice guy. He has no interest in invading any countries. He's more interested in, you know, conservation and that kind of stuff. So he just compiles information. I don't know what he does for the CIA, but I don't see it as being necessarily all negative. But people often perceive it as being negative, and you have to be very careful of what you do. And you don't want to get seen as a CIA agent by anybody anywhere, unless you actually are.
Yeah, you can totally lose trust. It's just another reason why science should be removed from politics, at least at that stage. You know,
right.
You're gathering information, the pure research stage.
Yeah.
We've got about an hour and a half of material here, I think.
It was a great chat. I wondered if I can issue a correction about something I said earlier in the conversation.
Yeah.
You had mentioned that the question of whether the polio vaccine could have just been like killed in the heat, I think, or you know, destroyed in transit, and the answer I gave you was sort of half baked, and so I wanted to not really, but the researchers did, you know, do tests to ensure that it wasn't the case that the vaccine had just been, you know, destroyed because it was, you know, stored at too high a temperature or something as it was being shipped. And they, I'm pretty sure how they ruled out that possibility was that they, so like I talked about before, it's weakened virus in the vaccine. And I think they were able to just do very simple experiments with cells in petri dishes where they exposed the cells to the virus in the vaccine, and were able to see that there was the level of virus that they thought there should be, okay. You know, that the manufacturers, you know, had made it to contain, which is, you know, a safe level, which, you know, is just enough to elicit an immune response. And I think that's pretty straightforward experiments to do. I think they're pretty early on able to rule out pretty conclusively that it was just, you know, a bum batch of vaccine that they were getting.
Good. Okay. I'll try to figure out how to insert that into that section. That was
let me know.
Yeah, that was a question. I was just going to say that was a question from my friend Dave, who's a listener to the show. So if any of you listeners see me around at any event and you want to ask questions about the next one, feel free to ask. You might even get on the show.
Yeah, good question that Dave had. He should pat himself on the back, because that was one of the first questions the researchers asked themselves about what was really going on with this vaccine. They wanted to eliminate all the simple explanations first.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think we've pretty much covered everything. We definitely have enough to work with.
Well, good. I'm glad. It was a lot of fun talking with both of you. Thank you for to cover this story and my reporting. Do you know when you'll have this podcast out? You probably have a backlog.
Well, it's just this one show that we work at a time, but, you know, we take turns editing and popping out and stuff like that. So depending on other things that we're doing, it might be about a week or so, or it might be a few days. But we'll definitely make sure we send you an email when the link is there.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's very exciting.
It'll just be a few days. This is technically a monthly podcast, but we don't say when it is. Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're not that tight in the schedule because we are working with the problem of not really understanding the technology well enough, and it takes us – we don't know how long it takes to do everything. So, you know, we'll definitely edit this over the next couple of days, and it'll probably be this week sometime.
Okay, great. And so are you hoping that Conacast will continue to be like a monthly podcast? What are your goals for it? Because I just learned about it when you invited me to be on it. I guess, it's pretty new, but it's interesting to find out about what you're doing.
Oh, yeah.
It's brand new, and we're not, you know, I think we made it monthly so that we wouldn't have the problem of not getting it done when we, you know, of deadlines. And it may evolve a little bit. We might do some shows where we have more than one topic, that sort of thing, but it just started, and it's just been a few weeks now, so we're hoping that the old Minnesota Atheist Talk audience listens to it. I have a fair number of readers on my blog who go to it, so we're just hoping that it develops and becomes more. We haven't gotten a lot of feedback yet as to how people would like to see us do it differently, so yeah, I think it's just going to continue to be a monthly project.
Oh, that sounds good. And it's supported by, you said, Minnesota Atheist Group?
No. We were on the radio when I lived in Minnesota. I'm in Arizona now. I was on the radio almost weekly, and Greg would join me maybe once a month or so when I wanted to do a good science show with science as a topic, because even though his specialties are anthropology and archaeology, just the way that he processes data is very well trained, and he helps make great interviews for science. One of the best ones that we did together was Neil deGrasse Tyson. He came on the radio, and it was a fantastic interview. So,
well, we just wanted to keep doing some interviews now and then.
Yeah.
So, you know, since Mike's not any longer producing or hosting at Minnesota Atheist, we just decided we'd try this podcast. We've always had the idea of doing a podcast. And this was a chance to actually jump and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, there's it's really good. I mean, I feel like science podcasts are, you know, of course, there's been like Radiolab and, you know, those for a while. But, you know, like one of my professors at Columbia, Vincent Racaniello, has this This Week in Virology podcast. I feel like it's kind of, you know, become trendy for professors to have a podcast. So I'm hoping this is like a medium that people like by which people want to hear about science, learn about science.
No, especially when creationism was a lot bigger in the news than it is now, like maybe 10 years ago. There was a lot of criticism of scientists that they didn't actually take their work out of the lab or out of the journals and stuff like that and get it out to the public. And I think that they're starting to see a lot more value in doing that now than they used to. Because, you know, Carl Sagan used to get so much criticism for doing popular work on science because people thought he had lost his seriousness as an astronomer when he started being on TV all the time. And there was always the kind of that fear that would hurt their careers. But I think that's kind of changing, so there's not that much fear, you know. And I think, too,
I hope so.
And I know that our friend, our mutual friend Eric Johnson, who lives in Vancouver, was complaining, or he pointed to an article where there was still some hesitance for scientists to do that, and so we reminded him of the podcast and the reason that we do it. So,
well, academia has gotten into producing more scientists than they have jobs for, and then people are developing their talents out in different areas. I think academia needs to start capturing some of that talent and bringing it back. And, you know, I think we need to have this is interesting. I mean, you're a science journalist who is a scientist, and that's what I am. I don't consider myself to be a journalist. It's interesting when you have public money and journals and major media outlets and so on making decisions about how much to put into science information distribution at a time when science policy is so critically important in this world. And, for example, in the U.S. Congress, there are something like 5 people who have any science background making laws, and the head of the science
committee cutting funding for science.
Mm-hmm. Cutting funding all over the place, in both media cutting funding and science cutting funding. The head of the U.S. Senate Science and Technology Committee is a really, really serious science denier who's also running for president. You know, so really, I don't know. We're lucky that there's a lot of people who want to listen to and hear about science, I think.
Right, and I think that, there is so much beyond what gets politicized, but even what gets politicized, I wish that people, could think about it maybe in a more science-minded way and realize that, this science can really teach us so much if mm-hmm. we can't step out of, what we want the answer to be for, our certain cause. But, I think that a lot of science journalists are kind of in my boat where they started off as scientists and wanted to, love the science, but, just wanted to be able to learn about all different kinds instead mm-hmm. of, focus on their one area. And, it's a different, I guess, creative endeavor to write about science and to do the science. And, I was really attracted to that too. But I love, I think it takes on a whole mixed bag of scientists communicating science and mm-hmm. journalists and, bloggers. I see that you, Greg, have science blogs, right? You're on science blogs.
Yeah.
So, of course, podcasts, it's all great. So
you had one article that I thought was really interesting in Scientific American about prions, kind of evolving in the sense that they possibly can. I thought that was kind of fascinating. I hadn't heard about that before.
Prions?
Yeah. Oh. Like the mad cow disease and Jacob disease. This is way back. This is like 6 years ago that you published it, but I thought it was pretty fascinating. So.
Yeah, I haven't revisited that issue in a while. I have to admit, I don't even remember that story. But that is a totally interesting area. I was kind of thrilled to get the Pulitzer Center grant, not just to write about this, but to be mm-hmm. able to spend some time writing about it and writing several stories, because I think I've kind of swung so far in the direction away from basic science research, where you focus on one topic and trying mm-hmm. to, out and cover all these different things, and now I think I want to come back a little more to the middle and focus on, you know, certain, like, really drill down in certain topics, and so, you know.
Have you heard Lori Garrett? Have you ever read Lori Garrett's Becoming Plague?
Yeah, I did. It was actually an assignment in journalism school to read certain chapters. But, yeah, I didn't read the whole thing. But, yeah, she is a very good communicator.
That's what got me interested originally in emerging diseases and all that. And I was also working in Zaire during some of the Ebola outbreaks. And I had a lot of interaction with Ebola researchers about the Ebola reservoir and so on. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about it is it actually documents some of the early anti-vax activities the current American anti-vax thing has a relatively shallow history. But if you go back before that, an anti-vax movement emerged in relation to the swine flu fiasco, which happened during the Ford administration, when the CDC identified the swine flu as a possibly emerging epidemic. They were really afraid of it. And then Congress agreed to actually require everyone to get this vaccine, and they developed a vaccine. And while that was happening, the CDC and other scientists realized that the swine flu epidemic wasn't going to happen. And they couldn't stop Congress. And of course, a few people got sick from this disease, and then it started a whole anti-vax thing that occurred then. And then later in time, Gina Colata wrote her book, The Flu. I don't know if you read that book. It's a popular book on influenza.
Yeah. I haven't read it.
Well, her book, sadly, it's interesting about the history, tracking down the 1918 flu and figuring out the 1918 flu epidemic. And her book came out literally a few months before viral science figured out how influenza vaccines reproduce. You know, at the time that she wrote the book, it wasn't quite understood, and now it is understood. And if you go back and look at the swine flu epidemic and the 1918 epidemic and everything else, suddenly it becomes clear what happened. We now know what the flu was doing and how it mutated in the way it did. And it isn't the old story of a simple jump from one species to another doesn't work anymore. It's a much complicated, much more interesting story now. I think somebody should write, maybe you should write, the history of anti-vax movement in relation to how we've understood the flu vaccine and some other vaccines over the years, because it's it's just an interesting story. Why don't we have a good vaccine now? How did that develop? How was the swine flu epidemic of the 1970s, early 70s misunderstood, and how it influenced the anti-vax movement and so on. Somebody needs to rewrite Gina's book in a sense, because it's got the science has gone so far ahead.
The flu is a topic that just keeps coming back, right? Because if you talk with experts, they say that, you know, more than, you know, all the emerging diseases of the day, it's flu is the one that they really worry about when it's going to be a really bad flu strain to emerge. And I feel like we just need to keep doing research on that and writing about it for sure. And I think part of the reason they did that, this has been one of the reasons it's been a pretty light flu season, in addition to, you know, I think, you know, a lot of things we talked about, is because the experts have did a good job of predicting which flu strains, you know, the three flu strains that would be in circulation this season. So it's, I think the protection, at least when I did a story about this a couple months ago, it looked like the ones that were circulating were the ones that they included in the vaccine, which is nice. That's the goal every year.
I know that.
I just read Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. It's a post-apocalyptic novel about a thing is called the Georgian flu, comes from the Republic of Georgia, and it kills everybody within a few hours of getting it. So it's a great story, because it's the flu that actually is way worse than it could ever even be. I mean, it really literally kills 98% of the population in a couple weeks around the entire world, and then you get left with these people who are like a traveling Shakespearean actor musician group, and that's all that's left. And anyway, it's interesting.
I think one hole in that would be that it would be kind of hard for it to spread, because if it kills so fast, how to, you know, It just seems like that was one of the issues with the what's that virus that struck Africa a couple of years ago?
You mean the famous
Ebola? That was one of the issues with Ebola, is because of the fact that people get ill so fast that they really can't travel, and that's why it's mostly being confined to Western Africa. Any time it pops up, is just because of the fact that it doesn't survive in the body, or people too sick to travel. Or
the way to write that novel is to don't have any scientists in the novel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's almost the difference between that movie Outbreak with Dustin Hoffman, which, I think maybe that was sort of loosely based on an Ebola outbreak probably, and then Contagion, which came out a couple years ago, which is a Nipah virus, and I feel like they decided to maybe consult some scientists in putting together the story for Contagion. So there weren't quite as many laugh out loud moments from a scientist's point of view. I appreciate it. I think probably a lot of like Hollywood TV, popular media representations of science are getting better about making it realistic, true to scientists. To a degree, like, you still have to have drama, right? You have to take some artistic license, but, I think they're better about getting the things that are, important.
We have this friend in Minneapolis who's a physicist. He does a lot of consulting for movies, Jim Kalias, and he's done a lot of science consulting for a lot of the comic book movies and stuff like that, because he's kind of a comic book nerd, and he does classes.
Sounds like a dream job.
Yeah. Well, he does these classes. He's got a special seminar class series that he has at the University of Minnesota on the physics of superheroes, and it's a way to get people that might not otherwise be interested in physics to actually come into the class and have, like, a interesting introduction to the concept. So it's a great way to teach it, I think.
Yeah, that seems really smart.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I should probably get going. I need to... out pretty soon, but it was great. It was great talking with you, and thanks so much for inviting me to be part of Iconic.
Thank you for joining us.
We really appreciate it, and look forward to seeing that story on CNN Health. So.
Yeah, I think it should be. I think the schedule now is for it to publish on Tuesday.
Oh. Well, cool, Delaney. Oh, one other question I wanted to ask you, too, for your preference as far as when I put in the article on the page. Then do you want to have at least one reference to being Dr. Storrs, or just – I noticed that on your articles you just say Karine Storrs. Do you have a preference as far as that goes?
If you want – I don't know what your style is on Iconicast. If you want to say – if you want to put PhD after my name the first time, I mean – of course, doctor is okay too, but
sure.
I guess I like PhD more just because I want to make it clear I'm not an MD.
Okay.
Not that there's any problem with MD, but it's different, coming kind of a different set of knowledge, I guess.
What better than not be confusing? And plus, a PhD is much more honorable than a mere medical doctor.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I agree.
But you did do all that work to earn it, so we should at least mention it once here.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. I do think I should. I would like it. Yeah, if you say PhD, the first mention.
Okay, I'll do that.
Great.
All righty.
Okay.
Thank you.
Goodbye then.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Okay, Mike, we're all set then?
Yep, I think so. I'll do some work on it tonight and tomorrow, and then I'll send it to you once I've got my things kind of stitched together. And if you want to try and catch any ums and ahs and stuff like that I might have missed,
Sure. Okay, and I think I've got a good good recording of everything too.
Okay,
in case something goes wrong with yours.
How big are they? Are they pretty big, or are they?
The Audacity file is 141 minutes long.
Okay.
I don't know how big it is. And then the one we're still recording this Skype call, so I don't know how big it's going to be.
Yeah, I got one. The second one is an hour 13, and the first one I think was about 27 minutes. So.
Yeah.
So okay. Yeah. All right. I'll get to you when I got something.
Okay. Good. Right. Talk to you later.
Yep. Bye.
Right, bye.